Lengthen the better, predict and shorten the terrible. Sometimes prevent the terrible by settling for the merely bad. I've given up on trying to stop you people. Just taught my children to remember and learn and survive until someone finally breaks the cycle for good. I was confused.
Are you talking about burn down?
That was what I'd come to talk about, after all. 100 years, she predicted, 50 years ago. What else mattered? She only smiled. Transcribed interview. Translated from Obelisk Builder C, found in Tapita Plateau, Ruin Number 723, by Shinash Innovator Dibars. Date unknown. Transcriber unknown. Speculation. The first lorist? Personal. Baster, you should see this place. Treasures of history everywhere. Most of them too degraded to decipher, but still. Wish you were here. 2. Nasun feels like busting loose. Nasun stands over the body of her father, if one can call a tumbled mass of broken jewels a body. She's swaying a little, lightheaded, because the wound in her shoulder, where her father has stabbed her, is bleeding profusely. The stabbing is the outcome of an impossible choice he demanded of her, to be either his daughter or an origin. She refused to commit existential suicide. He refused to suffer an origin to live. There was no malice in either of them in that final moment, only the grim violence of inevitability. To one side of this tableau stands Shafa, Nasun's guardian, who stares down at what is left of Jija resistant Jekity in a combination of wonder and cold satisfaction. At Nasun's other side is Steel, her stone eater. It is appropriate to call him that now, hers, because he has come in her hour of need, not to help, never that, but to provide her with something, nevertheless. What he offers and what she has finally realized she needs is purpose. Not even Shafa has given her this, but that's because Shafa loves her unconditionally. She needs that love, too. Oh, how she needs it. But in this moment, when her heart has been most thoroughly broken, when her thoughts are their least focused, she craves something more solid. She will have the solidity that she wants. She will fight for it and kill for it, because she's had to do that again and again, and it is habit now. And if she is successful, she will die for it. After all, she is her mother's daughter, and only people who think they have a future fear death. In Nasun's good hand thrums a 3-foot-long tapering shard of crystal, deep blue and finely faceted, though with some slight deformations near its base that have resulted in something like a hilt. Now and again, this strange long knife flickers into a translucent, intangible, debatably real state. It's very real. Only Nasun's attention keeps the thing in her hands from turning her to colored stone the way it did her father. She is afraid of what might happen if she passes out from blood loss, so she would really like to send the sapphire back up into the sky to resume its default shape and immense size. But she can't. Not yet. There by the dormitory are the two reasons. Umber and Nita, the other two guardians of Found Moon. They're watching her, and when her gaze lands on them, there is a flicker in the lacing tendrils of silver that drift between the pair. No exchanged words or looks. Just that silent communion, which would have been imperceptible if Nasun were anyone but who she was. Beneath each guardian, delicate silvery tethers wend up from the ground into their feet, connected by the nerve and vein glimmer of their bodies to tiny shards of iron embedded in their brains. These taproot-like tethers have always been there. But maybe it's the tension of the moment that makes Nasun finally notice how thick those lines of light are for each guardian. Much thicker than the one linking the ground to Shafa. And at last she understands what that means. Umber and Nida are just puppets of a greater will. Nasun has tried to believe better of them, that they are their own people. But here, now, with the sapphire in her hands and her father dead at her feet, some maturations cannot wait for a more convenient season. So Nasun roots a torus deep within the earth, because she knows that Umber and Nida will sense this. It's a feint. She doesn't need the power of the earth, and she suspects they know it. Still, they react, Umber unfolding his arms, and Nida straightening from where she'd been leaning on the porch railing. Shafa reacts, too, his eyes shifting sideways to meet hers. It's an unavoidable tell that Umber and Nida will notice, but it cannot be helped. Nasun has no piece of the evil earth lodged in her brain to facilitate communication. Where matter fails, care makes do. He says, Nida! And that is all she needs.
Umber and Nida move. It's fast, so fast, because the silver lattice within each has strengthened their bones and tightened the cords of their muscles so that they can do what ordinary human flesh cannot.
A pulse of negation moves before them with storm surge inexorability, immediately striking the major lobes of Nasun's sesapine numb. But Nasun is already on the offensive. Not physically. She cannot contest them in that sphere of battle. And besides, she can barely stand. Will and the silver are all she's got left. So Nasun, her body still, her mind violent, snatches at the silver threads of the air around her, weaving them into a crude but efficient net. She's never done this before, but no one has ever told her that it can't be done. She wraps part of this around Nida, ignoring Umber because Shafa told her to. And indeed, she understands in the next instant why he told her to concentrate on only one of the enemy guardians. The silver she's woven around Nida should catch the woman up fast, like an insect slamming into a spider web. Instead, Nida stumbles to a halt, then laughs while threads of something else curl forth from within her and lash the air, shredding the net around her. She lunges for Nasun again, but Nasun, after boggling at the speed and efficacy of the guardian's retaliation, snatches stone up from within the earth to spear Nida's feet. This impedes Nida only a little. She bulls forward, breaking the rock shards off and charging with them, still jutting through her boots. One of her hands is held like a claw, the other a flat, finger-stiffened blade. Whichever of them reaches Nasun first will dictate how she begins tearing Nasun apart with her bare hands. Here Nasun panics, just a little, because she would lose control of the sapphire otherwise, but some. She can sense a raw, hungry, chaotic reverberation to the silver threads thrumming through Nida, like nothing she's ever perceived before, and it is somehow suddenly terrifying. She doesn't know what that strange reverberation will do to her, if any part of Nida should touch Nasun's bare skin. Her mother knows, though. She takes a step back, willing the sapphire long knife to move between her and Nida in a defensive position. Her good hand is still on the sapphire's hilt, so it looks as if she's brandishing a weapon with a shaking and far too slow hand. Nida laughs again, high and delighted, because they can both see that not even the sapphire will be enough to stop her. Nida's claw hand flails out, fingers splaying and reaching for Nasun's cheek, even as she weaves like a snake around Nasun's wild slash. Nasun drops the sapphire and screams, her dulled sesapine flexing desperately, helplessly. But all of the guardians have forgotten Nasun's other guardian. Steel does not appear to move. In one instant, He stands as he has for the past few minutes, with his back to the tumbled pile of jija, expression serene, posture languid, as he faces the northern horizon. In the next, he is closer, right beside Nasun, having transported himself so quickly that Nasun hears a sharp clap of displaced air. Anita's forward momentum abruptly stops as her throat is caught tight within the circle of Steele's upraised hand. She shrieks. Nasun has heard Nita ramble for hours in her fluttery voice, and perhaps that's made her think of Nita as a songbird, chattery and chirruping and harmless. This shriek is the cry of a raptor, savagery turning to fury as she is thwarted from stooping on her prey. She tries to wrench herself back, risking skin and tendon to get loose, but Steele's grip is as firm as stone. She's caught. A sound behind Nasun makes her jerk around. 10 feet from where she stands, Umber and Shafa have blurred together in hand-to-hand combat. She can't see what's happening. They're both moving too fast, their strikes swift and vicious. By the time her ears process the sounds of a blow, they've already shifted to a different position. She can't even tell what they're doing, but she is afraid. So afraid for Shafa. The silver in Umber flows like rivers, power being steadily fed to him through that glimmering taproot. The thinner streams in Shafa, however, are a wild chain of rapids and clogs, yanking at his nerves and muscles and flaring unpredictably in an attempt to distract him. Nasun can see by the concentration in Shafa's face that he is still in control, and that this is what has saved him. His movements are unpredictable, strategic, considered. Still, that he can fight at all is astonishing. How he ends the fight, by driving his hand up to the wrist through the underside of Umber's jaw, is horrifying. Umber makes an awful sound, jerking to a halt. But an instant later his hand lunges for Shafa's throat again, blurring in its speed. Shafa gasps, so quickly that it might be just a breath. But Nasun hears the alarm in it and shunts away the strike. But Umber's still moving, even though his eyes have rolled back in his head and the movements are twitchy, clumsy. Nasun understands then. Umber is not home anymore. Something else is working his limbs and reflexes for as long as crucial connections remain in place. And yes, in the next breath, Shafa flings Umber to the ground, wrenches his hand free, and stomps on his opponent's head. Nasun can't look. She hears the crunch. That's enough. She hears Umber actually continue twitching, his movements more feeble than persistent. And she hears the faint rustle of Shafa's clothes as he bends. Then she hears something that her mother last heard in a little room in the guardian's wing of the fulcrum, some 30 years before. Bone cracking and grizzle tearing as Shafa works his fingers into the base of Umber's broken skull. Nasun can't close her ears. So instead she focuses on Nita, who's still fighting to get free from Steele's unbreakable grip.
I...
Nasun attempts. Her heart's slowed only a little. The sapphire shakes harder in her hands. Nita still wants to kill her. Steele, who has established himself as merely a possible ally and not a definite one, need only loosen his grip. And Nasun will die. But...
I don't want to kill you, she manages.
It's even true. Nita abruptly goes still and silent. The fury in her expression gradually fades to no expression at all.
It did what it had to do last time, she says.
Nasun's skin prickles with the realization that something intangible has changed. She's not sure what. But she doesn't think this is quite Nita anymore. She swallows. Did what? Who? Nita's gaze falls on Steele. There is a faint, grinding sound as Steele's mouth curves into a wide, toothy smile. Then, before Nasun can think of another question to ask, Steele's grip shifts, not loosening, turning with that unnaturally slow motion which perhaps is meant to imitate human movement, or mock it. He draws in his arm and pivots his wrist to turn Nita around, her back to his front, the nape of her neck to his mouth. "It's angry," Nita continues calmly, though now she faces away from both Steele and Nasun. "Yet even now it may be willing to compromise, to forgive. It demands justice, but it has had its justice 1,000 times over," says Steele. "I owe it no more." Then he opens his mouth wide. Nasun turns away, again. On a morning when she has rent her father to pieces, some things remain too obscene for her child's eyes. At least Nita does not move again once Steele has dropped her body to the ground.
"We cannot remain here," Shafa says.
When Nasun swallows hard and focuses on him, she sees that he stands over Umber's corpse, holding something small and sharp in one gore-flecked hand. He gazes at this object with the same detached coldness that he turns upon those he means to kill.
"Others will come."
Through the clarity of near-death adrenaline, Nasun knows that he means other contaminated guardians, and not half-contaminated ones like Shafa himself, who have somehow managed to retain some measure of free will.
Nasun swallows and nods, feeling calmer now that no one is actively trying to kill her anymore.
"What about the other kids?"
Some of the children in question are standing on the porch of the dormitory, awakened by the concussion of the sapphire when Nasun summoned it into long knife form. They have witnessed everything Nasun sees. A couple are weeping at the sight of their guardians dead, but most just stare at her and Shafa in silent shock. One of the smaller children is vomiting off the side of the steps. Shafa gazes at them for a long moment and then glances sidelong at her. Some of the coldness is still there, saying what his voice does not. They'll need to leave Jekity, quickly. Without guardians, the calm folk are unlikely to tolerate their presence. Or Shafa can kill them. That's what he's done with every other origin they've met who isn't under his control. They are either his, or they are a threat.
"No," Nasun blurts,
speaking to that silent coldness, not to what he's said. The coldness increases fractionally. Shafa never likes it when she says no. She takes a deep breath, marshaling a little more calm, and corrects herself.
"Please, Shafa, I can't take any more."
This is rank hypocrisy. The decision Nasun has recently made, a silent promise over her father's corpse, belies it. Shafa cannot know what she has chosen, but at the corner of her vision, she is painfully aware of Steele's lingering blood-painted smile. She presses her lips together and means it anyway. It isn't a lie. She can't take the cruelty, the endless suffering. That's the whole point. What she means to do will be, if nothing else, quick and merciful. Shafa regards her for a moment. Then he twitch winces a little, as she has seen him do often in the past few weeks. When the spasm passes, he puts on a smile and comes over to her, though first he closes his hand firmly around the metal bit he's taken from Umber.
"How is your shoulder?"
She reaches up to touch it. The cloth of her sleep shirt is wet with blood, but not sodden, and she can still use the arm.
"It hurts."
"That will last for a time, I'm afraid."
He looks around, then rises and goes to Umber's corpse, ripping off one of Umber's shirt sleeves, one that isn't as splattered with blood as the other, Nasun notes with distant relief.
He comes over and pushes up her sleeve, then helps her tie the strip of cloth around her shoulder. He ties it tight. Nasun knows this is good and will possibly prevent her from needing to have the wound sewn up. But for the moment, the pain is worse, and she leans against him briefly. He allows this, stroking her hair with his free hand. The gore-flecked other hand, Nasun notes, stays clenched tight around that metal shard. "What will you do with it?" Nasun asks, staring at the clenched hand. She cannot help imagining something malevolent there, snaking its tendrils forth and looking for another person to infect with the evil Earth's will.
"I don't know," Shafa says in a heavy voice. "It's no danger to me. But I remember that, and..."
He frowns for a moment, visibly groping for a memory that is gone.
"That once, elsewhere. We simply recycled them.
Here, I suppose. I'll have to find somewhere isolated to drop it, and hope no one stumbles across it any time soon."
"What will you do with that?"
Nasun follows his gaze to where the sapphire long knife, untended, has floated around behind her and positioned itself in the air, hovering precisely a foot away from her back. It moves slightly with her movements, humming faintly. She doesn't understand why it's doing that, though she takes some comfort from its looming quiescent strength.
"I guess I should put it back."
"How did you..."
"I just needed it. It knew what I needed and changed for me."
Nasun shrugs a little. It's so hard to explain these things in words. Then she clutches at his shirt with her uninjured hand, because she knows that when Shafa doesn't answer a question, it isn't a good thing.
"The others, Shafa."
He sighs finally.
"I'll help them prepare packs. Can you walk?"
Nasun's so relieved that for the moment she feels like she can fly.
"Yes, thank you. Thank you, Shafa."
He shakes his head, clearly rueful, though he smiles again.
"Go to your father's house and take anything useful and portable, little one. I'll meet you there."
She hesitates. If Shafa decides to kill the other children of Found Moon...
"He won't, will he?"
"He said he won't." Shafa pauses, raising an eyebrow above his smile, the picture of polite, calm inquiry. It's an illusion. The silver is still a lashing whip within Shafa, trying to goad him into killing her. He must be in astonishing pain. He resists the goad, however, as he has for weeks. He does not kill her, because he loves her. And she can trust nothing, no one, if she does not trust him.
"Okay," Nasun says. "I'll see you at Daddy's."
As she pulls away from him, she glances at Steele, who has turned to face Shafa as well. Somewhere in the past few breaths, Steele has gotten the blood off his lips. She doesn't know how, but he has held out one gray hand toward them. No, toward Shafa. Shafa tilts his head at this for a moment, considering. And then after a moment he deposits the bloody iron shard into Steele's hand. Steele's hand flicks closed, then uncurls again, slowly, as if performing a sleight-of-hand trick. But the iron shard is gone. Shafa inclines his head in polite thanks. Her two monstrous protectors who must cooperate on her care. Yet is Nasun not a monster too? Because the thing that she sensed just before Jija came to kill her, that spike of immense power, concentrated and amplified by dozens of obelisks working in tandem. Steele has called this the Obelisk Gate, a vast and complex mechanism created by the dead sieve that built the obelisks for some unfathomable purpose. Steele has also mentioned a thing called the moon. Nasun has heard the stories. Once, long ago, Father Earth had a child. That child's loss is what angered him and brought about the seasons. The tales offer a message of impossible hope and a mindless expression that lorists use to intrigue restless audiences. One day, if the Earth's child ever returns, the implication is that someday Father Earth might be appeased at last. Someday, the seasons might end and all could become right with the world. Except fathers will still try to murder their origin children, won't they? Even if the moon comes back? Nothing will ever stop that. Bring home the moon, Steele has said. End the world's pain. Some choices aren't choices at all, really. Nasun wills the sapphire to come hover before her again. She confesses nothing in the wake of Umber and Nita's negation, but there are other ways to perceive the world. And amid the flickering unwater of the sapphire, as it unmakes and remakes itself from the concentrated immensity of silver light stored within its crystal lattice, there is a subtle message written in equations of force and balance that Nasun solves instinctively, with something other than math. Far away, across the unknown sea, her mother may hold the obelisk gate's key, but Nasun learned on the Ash Roads that there are other ways to open any gate. Hinges to pop, ways to climb over or dig under. And far away on the other side of the world is a place where Esun's control over the gate can be subverted. I know where we need to go, Shafa, Nasun says. He eyes her for a moment, his gaze flicking to Steele and back. Do you know? Yes. It's a really long way, though. She bites her lip. Will you go with me? He inclines his head, his smile wide and warm. Anywhere, my little one. Nasun lets out a long breath of relief, smiling up at him tentatively. Then she deliberately turns her back on Found Moon and its corpses, and walks down the hill without ever once looking back. 2729 Imperial. Witnesses in the calm of Amund, Dibba, Courtant, Western Nomid Lats, report an unregistered Raga female opening up a gas pocket near the town. Unclear what gas was. Killed in seconds, purpling of tongue, suffocation rather than toxicity? Both? Another Raga female reportedly stopped the first one's efforts somehow and shunted the gas back into the vent before sealing it. Amund citizens shot both as soon as possible to prevent further incidents. Gas pocket assessed by Fulcrum as substantial. Enough to have killed most people and livestock in western half of Nomid Lats, with follow-up topsoil contamination. Initiating female age, 17, reacting to reported molester of younger sister. Quelling female age, 7, sister of first. Project notes of Yater, Innovator D-Bars. Sil Anagist. 5. Hoa, says a voice behind me. Me? Me. I turn from the stinging window and the garden of winking flowers. A woman stands with Gewa and one of the conductors, and I do not know her. To the eyes, she is one of them, skin a soft all-over brown, eyes gray, hair black-brown and curling in ropes. Tall. There are hints of other in the breath of her face. Or perhaps, viewing this memory now through the lens of millennia, I see what I want to see. What she looks like is irrelevant. To my Sasapine, her kinship to us is as obvious as Gehua's puffy white hair. She exerts a pressure upon the ambient that is a churning, impossibly heavy, irresistible force. This makes her as much one of us as if she'd been decanted from the same biomagestric mix.
You look like her.
No, I want you to look like her.
That is unfair, even if it's true.
You are like her, but in other ways than mere appearance. My apologies for reducing you in such a way. The conductor speaks as her kind do, in thin vibrations that only ripple the air and barely stir the ground.
Words.
I know this conductor's name word, Phelan. And I know, too, that she is one of the nicer ones. But this knowledge is still and indistinct, like so much about them. For a very long time I could not tell the difference between one of their kind and another. They all look different, but they have the same non-presence within the ambient. I still have to remind myself that hair textures and eye shapes and unique body odors each have as much meaning to them as the perturbations of tectonic plates have to me. I must be respectful of their difference. We are the deficient ones, after all, stripped of much that would have made us human. This was necessary, and I do not mind what I am. I like being useful, but many things would be easier if I could understand our creators better. So I stare at the new woman, the us woman, and try to pay attention while the conductor introduces her. Introduction is a ritual that consists of explaining the sounds of names and the relationships of the families, professions. Honestly, I don't know. I stand where I am supposed to and say the things I should. The conductor tells the new woman that I am Hua and that Gehua is Gehua, which are the name words they use for us. The new woman, the conductor says, is Kalenli. That's wrong, too. Her name is actually Deep Stab, breach of clay sweet burst, soft silicate underlayer, reverberation. But I will try to remember Kalenli when I use words to speak. The conductor seems pleased that I say, "How do you do?" when I'm supposed to. I'm glad. Introduction is very difficult, but I've worked hard to become good at it. After this, she starts speaking to Kalenli. When it becomes clear that the conductor has nothing more to say to me, I move behind Gehua and begin plaiting some of her thick, poofy mane of hair. The conductors seem to like it when we do this, though I don't really know why. One of them said that it was cute to see us taking care of one another just like people. I'm not sure what cute means. Meanwhile, I listen.
"Just doesn't make sense," Phelan is saying with a sigh. "I mean, the numbers don't lie, but..."
"If you'd like to register an objection," begins Kalenli. Her words fascinate me in a way that words never have before. Unlike the conductor, her voice has weight and texture, strata deep and layered. She sends the words into the ground while she speaks, as a kind of sub-vocalization. It makes them feel more real. Phelan, who doesn't seem to notice how much deeper Kalenli's words are, or maybe she just doesn't care, makes an uncomfortable face in reaction to what she's said. Kalenli repeats, "If you'd like to, I can ask Galat to take me off the roster."
And listen to his shouting. Evil death, he'd never stop. Such a savage temper he has.
Phelan smiles. It's not an amused smile.
"It must be hard for him, wanting the project to succeed, but also wanting you kept well. I'm fine with you on standby only. But then I haven't seen the simulation data."
"I have." Kalenli's tone is grave. "The delay failure risk was small, but significant."
"Well, there you are. Even a small risk is too much if we can do something about it. I think they must be more anxious than they're letting on, though, to involve you.
Abruptly, Phelan looks embarrassed.
Sorry. No offense meant.
Calenly smiles.
Both I and Gehua can see that it is only a surface layering, not a real expression.
None taken.
Phelan exhales in relief. Well then, I'll just redraw the observation and let you three get to know each other. Knock when you're done.
With that, Conductor Phelan leaves the room. This is a good thing, because when conductors are not around, we can speak more easily. The door closes and I move to face Gehua, who has actually cracked geode taste of agilorescent salts, fading echo. She nods minutely, because I have correctly guessed that she has something important to tell me. We are always watched. A certain amount of performance is essential.
Gehua says with her mouth,
Coordinator Phelan told me they're making a change to our configuration. With the rest of her, she says, in atmospheric perturbations and anxious plucking of the silver threads, Tetlewa has been moved to the briar patch.
A change at this late date? I glance at the Uswoman Calenly to see if she is following the whole conversation. She looks so much like one of them. All that surface coloring and those long bones that make her a head taller than both of us.
Do you have something to do with the project? I ask her, while also responding to Gewa's news about Tetlewa.
No. My no is not denial, just a statement of fact.
We can still detect Tetlewa's familiar hotspot roil and strata uplift. Grind of subsidence, but something is different.
He's not nearby anymore, or at least he's not anywhere that is in range of our seismic questings, and the roil and grind of him have gone nearly still.
Decommissioned is the word the conductors prefer to use when one of us is removed from service. They have asked us individually to describe what we feel when the change happens, because it is a disruption of our network. By unspoken agreement, each of us speaks of the sensation of loss, a pulling away, a draining, a thinning of signal strength. By unspoken agreement, none of us mentions the rest, which in any case is indescribable using conductor words. What we experience is a searing sensation and prickling all over, and the tumble-down resistance tangle of ancient pre-selenogistic wire, such as we sometimes encounter in our explorations of the Earth, gone rusted and sharp in its decay and wasted potential. Something like that. Who gave the order? I want to know. Gehua has become a slow fault ripple of stark, frustrated, confused patterns.
Conductor, Galot.
The other conductors are angry about it. And someone reported it to the higher-ups, and that's why they have sent Calenly here. It took all of us together to hold the Onyx and the Moonstone. They are concerned about our stability.
Annoyed, I return. Perhaps they should have thought of that before.
I do have something to do with the project, yes?
Interrupts Calenly, though there has been no break or disruption of the verbal conversation.
Words are very slow compared to Earth talk.
I have some arcane awareness, you see, and similar abilities to yours.
Then she adds, I'm here to teach you. She switches as easily as we do between the words of the conductors and our language, the language of the Earth. Her communicative presence is radiant heavy metal, searing crystallized magnetic lines of meteoric iron, and more complex layers underneath this, also sharp-edged and powerful,
that Gewa and I both inhale in wonder.
But what is she saying? Teach us? We don't need to be taught. We were decanted knowing nearly everything we needed to know already. And the rest we learned in the first few weeks of life with our fellow tuners. If we hadn't, we would be in the briar patch now. I make sure to frown. How can you be a tuner like us?
This is a lie, spoken for our observers, who see only the surface of things and think we do too.
She is not white like us, not short or strange, but we have known her for one of ours since we felt the cataclysm of her presence. I do not disbelieve that she is one of us. I can't disbelieve the incontrovertible.
K'lenli smiles with a wryness that acknowledges the lie.
Not quite like you, but close enough.
You're the finished artwork. I'm the model.
Threads of magic in the earth heat and reverberate and add other meanings.
Prototype. A control to our experiment, made earlier to see how we should be done. She has only one difference instead of the many that we possess. She has our carefully designed Sesapine. Is it enough to help us accomplish the task? The certainty in her earth presence says yes. She continues in words.
I'm not the first that was made, just the first to survive.
We all push a hand at the air to ward off evil death. But I allow myself to look like I don't understand as I wonder if we dare trust her. I saw how the conductor relaxed around her. Phelan is one of the nice ones, but even she never forgets what we are. She forgot with K'lenli, though. Perhaps all humans think she is one of them, until someone tells them otherwise.
What is that like? Being treated as human when one is not.
And then there's the fact that they've left her alone with us. We they treat like weapons that might misfire at any moment. But they trust her.
How many fragments have you attuned to yourself, I ask, aloud, as if this is a thing that matters. It is also a challenge.
Only one, K'lenli says, but still she is smiling. The onyx.
Oh, that does matter. Gehua and I exchange a look of wonder and concern before facing her again.
And the reason I'm here, K'lenli continues, abruptly insistent upon delivering this important information with mere words, which somehow perversely serves to emphasize them, is because the order has been issued. The fragments are at optimum storage capacity and are ready for the generative cycle. Core point and zero site go live in 28 days. We're finally starting up the plutonic engine.
In tens of thousands of years, after people have repeatedly forgotten what engines are and know the fragments as nothing but obelisks, there will be a different name for the thing that rules our lives now. It will be called the Obelisk Gate, which is both more poetic and quaintly primitive. I like that name better.
In the present, while Gehua and I stand there staring, K'lenli drops one last shocker into the vibrations between ourselves.
That means I have less than a month to show you who you really are.
Gehua frowns. I manage not to react, because the conductors watch our bodies as well as our faces, but it is a narrow thing. I'm very confused and not a little unnerved. I have no idea in the present of this conversation that it is the beginning of the end. Because we tuners are not origins, you see. Orogeny is what the difference of us will become over generations of adaptation to a changed world. You are the shallower, more specialized, more natural distillation of our so unnatural strangeness. Only a few of you, like Alabaster, will ever come close to the power and versatility we hold. But that is because we were constructed as intentionally and artificially as the fragments you call obelisks. We are fragments of the great machine, too. Just as much a triumph of gen engineering and biomagistry and geomagistry and other disciplines for which the future will have no name. By our existence, we glorify the world that made us, like any statue or scepter or other precious object.
We do not resent this, for our opinions and experiences have been carefully constructed too.
We do not understand that what Kalenli has come to give us is a sense of peoplehood. We do not understand why we have been forbidden this self-concept before now. But we will. And then we will understand that people cannot be possessions. And because we are both, and this should not be, a new concept will take shape within us. Though we have never heard the word for it, because the conductors are forbidden to even mention it in our presence. Revolution. Well, we don't have much use for words, anyway. But that's what this is. The beginning. You, Esun, will see the end.
3. You, imbalanced. It takes a few days for you to recover enough to walk on your own. As soon as you can, Yika reappropriates your stretcher-bearers to perform other tasks, which leaves you to hobble along, weak and made clumsy by the loss of your arm. The first few days you lag well behind the bulk of the group, catching up to camp with them only hours after they've settled for the night. There isn't much left of the communal food by the time you go to take your share. Good thing you don't feel hunger anymore. There aren't many spaces left to lay out your bedroll, either. Though they did at least give you a basic pack and supplies to make up for your lost runny sack. What spaces there are aren't good, located near the edges of the camp, or off the road altogether, where the danger of attack by wildlife or calmness is greater. You sleep there anyway, because you're exhausted. You suppose that if there's any real danger, Hoa will carry you off again. He seems able to transport you for short distances through the earth with no trouble. Still, Yika's anger is a hard thing to bear, in more ways than one. Tonki and Hoa lag behind with you. It's almost like the old days, except that now Hoa appears as you walk, gets left behind as you keep walking, then appears again, somewhere ahead of you. Most times he adopts a neutral posture, but occasionally he's doing something ridiculous, like the time you find him in a running pose. Apparently, stone eaters get bored, too. Hjarka stays with Tonki, so that's four of you. Well, five. Lerna lingers to walk with you, too, angry at what he perceives as the mistreatment of one of his patients. He didn't think a recently comatose woman should be made to walk at all, let alone left to fall behind. You try to tell him not to stick with you, not to draw Kastrima's wrath upon himself. But he snorts and says that if Kastrima really wants to antagonize the only person in the comm who's formally trained to do surgery, they don't deserve to keep him. Which is, well, it's a very good point. You shut up. You're managing better than Lerna expected, at least. That's mostly because it wasn't really a coma, and also because you hadn't lost all of your road conditioning during the 7 or 8 months that you lived in Kastrima. The old habits come back easily, really, finding a steady, if slow, pace that nevertheless eats up the miles, wearing your pack low so that the bulk of its weight braces against your butt rather than pulling on your shoulders. Keeping your head down as you walk, so that the falling ash doesn't cover your goggles. The loss of the arm is more a nuisance than a real hardship, at least with so many willing helpers around. Aside from throwing off your balance and plaguing you with phantom itches or aches from fingers or an elbow that doesn't exist, the hardest part is getting dressed in the morning. It's surprising how quickly you master squatting to piss or defecate without falling over. But maybe you're just more motivated after days in a diaper. So you're holding your own, just slowly at first. And you're getting faster as the days go by. But here's the problem with all of this. You're going the wrong way. Tonki comes over to sit by you one evening.
You can't leave until we're a lot further west, she says without preamble. Almost to the Mertz, I'm thinking. If you want to make it that far, you're going to have to patch things up with Yika.
You glare at her. Though, for Tonki, this is discreet. She has waited till Hjarka is snoring in her bedroll, and Lerna's gone off to use the camp latrine. Hoa is still nearby, standing unsettled guard over your small group within the calm encampment, the curves of his black marble face underlit by your fire. Tonki knows he's loyal to you, though to the degree that loyalty means anything to him.
Yika hates me, you finally say, after glaring fails to produce anything like chagrin or regret in Tonki. She rolls her eyes. Trust me, I know hate. What Yika's got is scared. And a good bit of mad. But some of that you deserve. You've put her people in danger.
I saved her people from danger. Across the encampment, as if to illustrate your point, you notice someone moving about clunkily. It's one of the Renanis soldiers, a few of whom were captured alive after the last battle. They've put a pronger on her, a hinged wooden collar round her neck, with holes in the planks holding her arms up and apart, linked by two chains to manacles on her ankles. Primitive but effective. Lerna's been tending the prisoner's chafing sores, and you understand they're allowed to put the prongers aside at night. It's better treatment than Castremans would have gotten from Renanis if the situations were reversed. But still, it makes everything awkward. It's not like the Rennies can leave, after all. Even without the prongers, if any one of them escapes now, with no supplies and lacking the protection of a large group, there'll be meat within days. The prongers are just insult on top of injury. And a disquieting reminder to all that things could be worse. You look away. Tonki sees you looking.
Yeah, you saved Castrema from one danger, and then delivered them into something just as bad. Yika only wanted the first half of that.
I couldn't have avoided the second half. Should I have just let the Stone Eaters kill all the Ragas, kill her? If they'd succeeded, none of the geode's mechanisms would have worked anyway.
She knows that. That's why I said it wasn't hate, but...
Tonki sighs, as if you're being especially stupid.
Look, Castrema is an experiment. Not the geode, the people. She's always known it was precarious, trying to make a column out of strays and ragas. But it was working. She made the old-timers understand that we needed the newcomers. Got everybody to think of Ragas as people. Got them to agree to live underground in a dead civ ruin that could have killed us all at any moment. Even kept them from turning on each other when that gray stone-eater gave them a reason. I stopped that,
you mutter. But you're listening.
You helped, Tonki concedes. But if it had just been you... You know full well it wouldn't have worked. Castrema works because of Yika. Because they know she'll die to keep this calm going. Help Castrema, and Yika will be on your side again.
It will be weeks, maybe even months, before you reach the now vacant equatorial city of Renanis. I know where Nasun is now, you say, seething.
By the time Kastrima gets to Renanis, she might be somewhere else.
Tonki sighs. It's been a few weeks already, Iasun.
And Nasun was probably somewhere else before you even woke up.
You're shaking.
It's not rational, and you know it, but you blurt.
But if I go now, maybe I can catch up. Maybe Hoa can tune in on her again. Maybe I can...
Then you falter silent, because you hear the shaky, high-pitched note of your own voice, and your mother instincts kick back in, rusty, but unblunted, to chide you. Stop whining. Which you are. So you bite back more words, but you're still shaking a little.
Tonki shakes her head, an expression on her face that might be sympathy. Or maybe it's just rueful acknowledgement of how pathetic you sound.
Well, at least you know it's a bad idea. But if you're that determined, then you'd better get started now.
She turns away. Can't really blame her, can you? Venture into the almost certainly deadly unknown with a woman who's destroyed multiple communities, or stay with a calm that at least theoretically will soon have a home again? That's barely even a question.
But you should really know better than to try to predict what Tonki will do.
She sighs after you subside and sit back on the rock you've been using for a chair.
I can probably wrangle some extra supplies out of the quartermaster if I tell them I need to go scouting something for the innovators. They're used to me doing that. But I'm not sure I can convince them to give me enough for two.
It's a surprise to realize how grateful you are for her. Loyalty isn't the word for it. Attachment? Maybe. Maybe it's just that you've been her research subject for all this time already. So of course she's not going to let you slip away when she's followed you across decades and half the stillness.
But then you frown.
Two? Not three.
You thought things were working out with her and Hjarka.
Tonki shrugs, then awkwardly bends to tuck into the little bowl of rice and beans she has from the communal pot. After she swallows, she says,
I prefer to make conservative estimates. You better too.
She means Lerna, who seems to be in the process of attaching himself to you. You don't know why. You're not exactly a prize, dressed in ash and with no arm, and half the time he seems to be furious with you. You're still surprised it's not all the time. He always was a strange boy.
Anyway, here's a thing I want you to think about, Tonki continues. What was Nasun doing when you found her?
And you flinch, because dammit, Tonki has once again said aloud a thing that you would have preferred to leave unsaid and unconsidered. And because you remember that moment, with the power of the gate sluicing through you, when you reached and touched and felt a familiar resonance touch back. A resonance backed and amplified by something blue and deep and strangely resistant to the gate's linkage. The gate told you, somehow, that it was the sapphire. What is your 10-year-old daughter doing playing with an obelisk? How is your 10-year-old daughter alive after playing with an obelisk? You think of how that momentary contact felt. Familiar vibration taste of an orogeny which you've been quelling since before she was born, and training since she was 2, but so much sharper and more intense now. You weren't trying to take the sapphire from Nasun, but the gate was, following instructions that long-dead builders somehow wrote into the layered lattices of the onyx. Nasun kept the sapphire, though. She actually fought off the obelisk gate. What has your little girl been doing this long dark year to develop such skill?
You don't know what her situation is, Tonki continues, which makes you blink out of this terrible reverie and focus on her. You don't know what kind of people she's living with.
You said she's in the Antarctic, somewhere near the eastern coast. That part of the world shouldn't be feeling the season much yet. So what are you going to do, then? Snatch her out of a calm where she's safe and has enough to eat and can still see the sky, and drag her north?